Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in business and economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Spring Semester 2016. Lecture 10, delivered on February 15, 2016. The title of this lecture is Interest Rates in Finance.
Today, interest rates in finance. This topic actually covers some material that I've already gone through with you in the special topics week two. However, there is more to say about interest rates, and I'll also be showing you a few extended methods on your financial calculator that are important in finance. Bear with me 1 minute here. I'm going to pull up a couple of... Okay. Now, first things first, I'm going to pull up a visual here. Let me get up this... find the one that I want that I usually like to use. Okay. First things first. As far as interest rates go, madam, what would be a good base rate that would sort of on which all other interest rates might float or go up and down as that base rate goes up and down? What would it be? What would you say? Any? I got a hint at it up there. I'm trying to help here a little bit. What do you say?
I'm guessing around like 1.5.
No, I'm talking about an actual, the animal itself. What's it called? What rate would you be looking for that would be sort of a base rate on which all other interest rates would ride? Any estimate whatsoever? You got one?
The value of the dynamic yield curve.
Don't do that. Let's try a short-term T-bill rate. The yield on a short-term T-bill would probably be one place where you would start. Remember, because any interest rate that you are going to look at, R sub S, no, you don't. I got an actual brand new marker in my pocket here, I think. Ha. Any rate that you might want, R sub S, is going to start with the risk-free rate. And then to that is going to be added a risk premium comprising the default premium, the maturity premium, and the liquidity or the illiquidity premium. We call these three components the risk premium. A good question on a first exam, one of the ones that would be more of a just a guinea straight up definition. What is the risk what are the components of the risk premium? And explain each in one sentence. Well, the risk premium comprises the default premium, the maturity premium, and the liquidity premium. That would be the start of that would get you about half a point. Okay? Now the risk-free rate is a theoretical that represents just the pure opportunity cost of foregone consumption. We proxy it with a very short-term treasury bill rate because the treasury bill is risk-free. It's not perfect, but it's as close as we'll ever see in the real world. This is, again, the risk-free rate. Now, remember that the risk-free rate has two pieces: the real rate and the expected inflation premium. The real rate and the expected inflation premium. We can't really peel those two apart. Now, if someone gives you an interest rate, like a bank rate, That would almost certainly be a nominal rate. It would include the inflation premium, the expected inflation premium. We could talk about a real rate, and that would generally mean that we had stripped out the inflation premium out of it. But in the real world, you're always going to be quoted a nominal rate. In other words, you're not going to hear a bank tell you, well, the interest rate, the real interest rate is, they'll say the nominal rate, because that's the rate they're going to charge you. Any rate you would ever be charged would probably be the nominal rate. Now, there was a long time back, as a matter of fact, it was kind of a hot idea back when I was doing PhD work in real estate finance, of offering loans where the interest rate that was on the loan was actually the real rate. It wasn't the nominal rate. But what they would do is every year they would adjust the balance that you owed up by how much inflation had happened over the year. It sounds like an incredible thing because that made the real rate is always pretty darn low. Usually pretty darn low. But what would happen is, as every year, they would ratchet up the balance on your loan and then recalculate your payments based on this new balance and the real rate. Turned out to be an absolute boondoggle disaster of an idea, because most salaries, especially at that time, were not tracking inflation. So people were essentially being creamed. Their balances were skyrocketing. Their payments were going up as a result, but their salaries were not tracking inflation. As a matter of fact, historically, at best, wages have lagged inflation severely. At worst, they have never caught up with inflation in many sectors of the economy. So there you go. Anyway. So, in other words, one place we could see as a basis for determining how interest rates would move would be this proxy by a T-bill yield. Well, we're going to charge you the T-bill rate plus 6%, something like that. There are other rates that are used by financial institutions. The T-bill rate is actually not the most popular. Another one that you would might see banks use as the basis for the interest rates that they charge for loans would be the Fed funds rate. In other words, that it would be the Fed funds rate plus 4%, the Fed funds rate plus 2.8%. In other words, the lending rate that banks charge each other for borrowing money plus a premium. That's one. Another one that is very popular, especially overseas, is called LIBOR. LIBOR, have any of you ever heard of LIBOR? You might hear in a London bank, well, we charge LIBOR plus 4. LIBOR is a London interbank offering rate. It is sort of like a composite of currencies, the rate on currencies from a basket of Western countries, and it floats around. It was the subject of a massive scandal more than a few years back, because it turned out the LIBOR was being fixed. It was just basically plain old price fixing. The LIBOR rate was being fixed by highly reputable companies and players around the world. This small cluster of brokers was playing it with the help of a publishing house that published the LIBOR rate. And so it didn't lose much of its luster, but you know, there you go. It's just another one of those rates. The T-bill yield, the Fed's funds rate, the LIBOR, those are different sort of like basic rates that a bank might use as its starting point for charging you for your loan. You want a car at a bank, they might use the Fed funds rate plus 3. Now, real quick here, I actually, I could have done it right there. Bear with me. Fed funds rate today, bankrate.com. God, I hate those stupid ass ads like that. Anyway, okay. Now, the Fed funds rate this week is 50 basis points. It's been floating there for about a month since the Fed announced a more aggressive policy. A year ago, it was 25 basis points. Essentially, that's the rate that banks charge each other. The Fed can't set this rate, but it can make it move in the direction it wants by causing money to be drained out of the federal funds pool that banks have for lending. If they drain that pool through open market operations, the Fed funds rate goes up. And that's what it's done. Quite recently, give me another one. Okay. Prime, there's another one that's kind of popular. 50-50, 25. The federal discount rate. Remember the discount window at the Fed? And then these are other ones. I mean, there are a lot of these out there. Basically, big investment houses, big reputable reporting companies, they'll all offer their own basis rate. And you'll see banks take one like the WSJ prime rate. That's another one is a prime rate. These are all kinds of different ways that you can look. I wonder what LIBOR is right now, just out of curiosity. And I'm getting you, moving you up towards something. Well, actually, holy shit, okay. Notice what happened. This was when essentially the Fed's tight-fisted policy was at its maximum. It just kept draining liquidity, keeping the money supply in the federal funds market really low, which caused the Fed funds rate, the rate that banks lend each other, to be quite high. And therefore, any interest rates that were based on the Fed funds rate as their substrate were going to be high. And then, of course, all hell broke loose and the Fed found Jesus. And they started pouring money into the economy. Down, down, down. The economy kept saying, no, we're dead. Down, down, down some more. Are you alive? Nope. Down some more. Until the essentially, finally, the Fed just held it in the, really, since the beginning of 2009, just held it at almost zero. Just pouring so much money into the banks. Pouring money into the banks, that there was essentially hardly any interest rate they needed to charge. The supply of money in the interbank lending market was so high. The problem was, as I mentioned to you before, that this did not wake up the economy. The Fed was essentially continually buying treasury bills from banks, giving them extra money, more money, that went into the federal funds pool that banks could lend to each other and then also lend to everyone else. But it did not wake up the economy. The Federal Reserve pouring all this money in did not wake up the economy. The economy languished in hard, hard recession for several years. Now, I'm going to see if I... That was early in the course when you probably weren't listening too well to me, but can you tell me there were two reasons why, there was one core reason. Why didn't all this sudden, this money the Fed was shoveling into the banks, pouring into the federal funds market, keeping the federal funds rate low, why didn't that cause the economy to wake up? No, there was one core reason, but it had two aspects to it. Well, let me ask you this. I'm your father, and you are a lazy son of a bitch, of a son. You've been a disappointment, but I finally figured I got away. Every morning I go in, and you're sleeping, you're on your stomach like this. You've been playing Call of Duty all night, eating Cheetos, hanging out with disreputable friends. So one morning, there you are, still in your clothes. So I go in and I take a wad of $1,000 and stuff it in your ass pocket. And say there's $1,000 in your ass pocket. Go buy yourself some clothes, find a job, eat some good food. Would you wake up?
Probably not.
You wouldn't? I would. Hell, I'd be up there, I'd be rolling. But, well, it's different people. Okay, let me try this. Do you remember why it was that this did not wake up the economy? There were two reasons. And they were both kind of associated with each other. Remember, the Fed adds money to the economy by going to the banks, and essentially what I'll do is you will have T-bills, and you're a banker, you'll have T-bills and dollars. What I'll do is a Fed trader at the domestic desk, I'll say, I'd like to buy some of your T-bills. As I demand more, then the price goes up and T-bill yields go down. But eventually you say, yeah, so I buy your T-bills and I give you money for them. That goes into the federal funds pool, which causes the Fed funds rate to drop. Okay? That's what you see there. But what these banks did is they'd go back to the next Treasury auction, because the Treasury was running such massive deficits, they were having auctions all the time. You just go back and buy more T-bills and then wait for me to call you again so I could buy more of them from you. So in other words, you'd go to the Fed auctions when the prices were falling because the supply of T-bills was going up. You'd buy them low, and then I'd call you as a trader at the desk, and I'd be pushing the price of them up. You'd sell them at a profit, and then you'd take the money that I had bought them for at that profit, and you'd go back to the next Treasury auction and buy more of them. The economy was not waking up. Then, with more of that money that you were making in these profits, you weren't lending it to businesses and people. You said there's a credit crunch. We can't lend. It's too risky. Oh, God. So what would you do? You'd invest in foreign securities. You'd invest in high-priced, fancy new instruments, derivatives. You'd do anything but lend it to that sorry ass right there who wanted to start a new little business or bring his business back from the dead that it had been in doldrums that it had been in since the recession began. That's why just bringing down the interest rate as the Fed was doing didn't cause the economy to wake up. It didn't do anything to the economy. For several years, the recession deepened, more bankruptcies, more people lost their homes, millions lost their homes, businesses collapsed, small businesses, all because the Fed was funneling money through these huge banks that were simply going with that money and buying more T-bills at the auctions. So that they could, when the prices were low, and they'd just wait for the Fed to start driving the prices up, demanding those T-bills, and they'd sell them off, and then they'd go back to the next auction because we were running massive federal budget deficits. So there you go. The upshot of that was that the liquidity that was being added to the economy was not being added to the base. It was just driving the stock market through the roof because, hell, these banks, these investment houses, they were using all that candy money the Fed was pouring out. They were buying stocks with it. Hence, the stock market went through the roof. Now the Fed has just barely blipped it up a little bit, and the stock markets had gotten so used to that, essentially that crack cocaine of money for nothing, that they just collapsed all over themselves as soon as the rates bumped up a little bit. That's where we are now. Okay, so there's the Fed funds rate. I'm going to check something real quick here. I'm going to check LIBOR. LIBOR today. Yeah, there are different LIBORs, of course. Looking at, let's say, a one-year LIBOR, it's down one basis point from what it was a year ago, or rather a month ago, but it is up almost double what it was a year ago. By the way, when I say basis points, one basis point is 0.001%. So I said it's down one basis point from what it was a month ago, but it is up way up. What is that? 37, 47, 50, almost 51 basis points from what it was a year ago. So, in other words, it has jumped quite a bit over the last year. Hence, you're going to have whatever it is that you're using as the basis here for the rates that you're charging on loans, taking these things as fixed, as whatever your substrate is, as that goes up, the interest rates on your loans will go up. The interest rate that you demand on investments goes up. And that's the second part of this that is absolutely critical that you understand. Interest rates aren't just for lending. When you make a profit in a business, an accounting profit, that is actually a cost because you got to do something with that. Okay? Now, as interest rates go up, your profit becomes more expensive. You've got to find something better to do with it. See, if you had $1,000 profit when interest rates were low, you could definitely find an easy investment that would clear that those low interest rate hurdles. But as interest rates go up, you have to find something much better yielding to do with that money. So even the equity residual claim becomes more expensive to the company as interest rates go up. And that's one of the hardest things to kind of get your mind around, is that debt and equity are both costs to the company. Interestingly, well, let me try this, see if you caught this one from my previous lectures. Which is more expensive, debt or equity?
Equity.
Absolutely. Equity is much more expensive than debt. So when interest rates in the economy go up, you would expect that the cost of equity is going to rise much more. In other words, the profit that the company makes becomes more and more expensive to the company. In other words, the company has to find a lot better to do with that equity when the hurdle rate is 20% than they did when the hurdle rate was 5%. You follow that idea? It's actually more expensive for you. Now, if the best interest rate you can get on your money is what it has been, like 0% or 0.1% on a CD, you got some extra money in your pocket, okay? And I see, you know, I'm your old uncle. You got all that extra money this month. You're making good money. You ought to be putting that away for a rainy day, saving that goddamn money. Yeah, there you go, irresponsible bastard. Anyway. But you look at CD rates, and oh yeah, the yield, the current yield on a 3-year CD is 0.25%. Oh, whoop-de-doo. Spend your money now. But suddenly, the current yield on a 1-year CD is 6%. Suddenly, that money in your pocket is a lot more expensive to keep in your pocket. Do you see that? You understand the idea? Let me go through that again. See, 6 months ago, if you had put that money in a CD, you would have gotten hardly anything back from it. But now, if you don't put that money in a CD, you're giving up 6%. Maybe in a year, 10%. It costs a lot more for you to keep that money in your pocket now than it did when interest rates were low. That's the idea. Remember the definition of an interest rate. At its heart, what is an interest rate? Can you give me one of the several definitions that I've given you so far? The opportunity cost of foregone consumption. Okay? An interest rate represents the best alternative you have to giving up using your money now. So when interest rates are low, that means that there's not much cost to giving up future consumption. You might as well use your money now. But when interest rates are high, that means the opportunity cost is much more expensive. Okay? Follow that. If you could come out of high school and get an $80,000 a year job, would you be here? Oh, hell no. But you see, you can't get an $80,000. But if you could, you would do something in the here and now rather than postponing and investing. Okay? Now, the other definition of interest rate is a rental rate on money. It's a rental rate. Just like any rate is, it's a rental rate. So what I'm going to get to here now, well, no, I want to take you back here. I want to show you the yield curve right now. Remember what I said about yield curves. Talk to me. Healthy, unhealthy yield curve, that's the one right today. Is that healthy, unhealthy, kind of, it's hard, kind of hard to say. What do you say? Okay, that's reasonable. First of all, does this yield curve have an inversion in it? Is this an inverted? No. That's right there. If you see an inversion, you start having your back leg thump and you head for the hills. No inverted yield curve there, so that means no, we're not going to see a recession in the near future. There's no that turn downward and then coming back up just ain't there. It's just not. So that's right there, my first indication, my first sentiment that this is not anything too bad right now. Now, reading it a little more deeply, I really like to see a yield curve that has a cleaner arc to it. This one comes up and then kaboom, it just rolls like a line instead of having a nice gentle curve off. That is a little troubling to me right there. I'm not sure how to interpret it other than that the markets are having a really funny feeling that there's going to be an inflation down the road. The forward rates out here, in other words, rates that are forming to create this piece right here and these pieces right here, they're not tailing off. They just keep rising in a linear fashion, or a log linear fashion, if you will. Okay, now let's look at what the yield curve has been doing. That is freaking weird. Look at how the yield curve is flattening. Do you see that? Oh, but see this right here? The yield curve came down and now it's arced back up. That is more inflation expectation right there. There, right there, you see that? That was a precursor, just the barest hint that there was an inversion that might have happened. I was a little concerned about this. Right in here, see this happened just a couple of weeks ago. Do you see how the curve was starting to have almost a little bit of a belly on it here? And then it's disappeared. Okay, that's wonderful, just wonderful. But that flat, that is something that I rarely see unless there's an inflation coming. Unless there's an inflation coming. But, I mean, you know, if I were to do one on a test, I would show you a picture and I'd say, tell me what you see. Now, it would be one where you would give me a clear, straightforward, simple answer. I wouldn't want you to do nuances in it. Keep that in mind. I'm trying to warn you about what I'll ask you on the first in-class test. Okay? I'm not going to give you some really complicated one. This one right here is actually, as simple as that looks, that's actually a nuanced one that kind of, it's actually kind of weirding me there. I didn't see it. The last time I looked at it, to be honest with you, was down here when I saw this creepy little attempt at an inversion. It was just having some thoughts about it. Just some thoughts. But then it got those thoughts out of its mind, and it popped into this straight line thing, which, again, that is creepy. I wouldn't give you one like this and say, well, you lose all your points because you didn't see this hint of inflation down the road. I'd give you something that was a more straightforward one, healthy, inverted, bad. If you see a yield curve that starts to drop from the beginning, it just drops. That's a sign that you might as well just, it's a zombie apocalypse there. Okay, but you're not seeing that here, but that is a little bit of a creepy one right there. Okay, now, moving on. Whatever it is, What are interest rates for? The first one that you would think of for as the cost of lent money. Money that is lent. Cost of money. You get an interest rate. That's the first thing you think of when you think about an interest rate. There are other things that they can be used for too. Interest rates are used for discounting cash flows. You've seen that, present value. I had to give you a discount rate. Third thing, interest rates are used for. This is actually related to the other one, but it's kind of, I kind of keep it. Securities pricing. Because basically, the price of a security is the present value of the future expected cash flows from it. So this is actually sort of like a subset of this one right here. And this one is a subset. It all pivots around this thing right here, discounting cash flows, figuring out what costs to lend money at, figuring out what securities prices are. It all boils down to discounting cash flows. Now, I showed you a sort of a way that you can price some stock, preferred stock and common stock. I showed you a way to do that in the formula for it and all that kind of stuff. You also, I showed you how you can use interest rates to figure out your loan payments. Very easy to do it, and it's actually worth it for you to do this kind of exercise. It was last Friday night. I was with a couple of people or finance people at a bank. I was telling them about some of the things that I show you they want to know. And what was it? Oh, the one guy, he sort of oversees lending operations, consumer lending operations. He said, well, you should have done it the other way. And I said, what do you mean the other way? He said, all right. He said, what we usually would you do, and I guess I did know this, he said, we would be looking for, let's say, a home loan. We would say, you should not have a loan payment that is more than, and he threw out a number. He said it varies on what you're using as your basis, 25% of your take-home pay per month. And he said, so what you should have done, and I can see that would have been a great idea, and I didn't do it. He said, say, what's the monthly take-home? Okay, take 30% of that. Make that your payment, put in your interest, and then go and find out what the price of the house is that you can afford. So let me show you that one real quick here so I can say to them the next time, well, yes, I do that. Anyway, real quick here, let me go over to Pearson. Bear with me one quick second here. Pull up, this is section four, so I'll pull up the financial calculator here. Financial calculator. There we go. Okay, so here's the deal. Find someone here who can tell me real quick. Madam, what's your starting annual salary going to be? What are you going to, you're going to say, I will not take one penny less than this. And of course, I'll say, well, we were actually going to offer you more than that, but if you want, what do you say?
50,000.
Okay. Huh?
50,000.
Okay, that's reasonable. That's reasonable. Okay, so let's take that. First and foremost, let's pull up $50,000 and let's take out a standard amount for your deductions and all that kind of stuff. So what we're going to do is your calculator. We're going to take a 50,000, and we're going to say that all your taxes and your health benefits taken together are going to eat up about 30% of your gross. So we're going to say times 0.7, And then we're going to divide that into 12 months. $2,916. Okay? Now, that's a little on the conservative side. You probably won't see 30% taken out, but this helps us out. Okay, so let's say it's going to be $2,900. So what we're going to do is we're going to say, I know this bank is going to reject any house that I would try to buy if I seek a loan that's more than 30% of my take home. So we're going to times this by 0.3. So I'm going to look at a house payment. They're going to say no to any house payment that is more than $870 a month. So let's take that off the board here for a bit. And we're going to start keying. Okay, the number of periods. We're going to say, let's take 12 times 30. So that's a 30-year loan. And we're going to put that in as the N. Now, the annual interest rate, we're going to be able to pull a 5.99% for the time being. And we'll put that in as the interest rate per year with 12 payments per year for the P over Y. And so we're now going to say, an $870 payment is what we can afford. And now let's compute the price value, what we can borrow from the bank. $145,000. That'll be your house if you want to buy. Okay? Now, a couple of things play off here. Interest is tax deductible. That's why borrowing debt is very attractive to companies, and especially to wealthier companies. It is also attractive to home buyers, especially to wealthier home buyers, because their marginal tax rate is higher. You will get to deduct your mortgage interest payments from your taxable income. So in your first year, about $145,000 times 6%, roughly, oh God, I could do this better, but I don't want to show you that yet. About $145,000 home. And in the first year, 6% of that, which is a little overstated, is $8,700 that is you get to take away from your taxable income, okay? So in other words, if you're in the marginal tax bracket, a 25% marginal tax bracket, that protects, you save $2,175 in tax, in federal tax. So it's actually better than you might think. And if you think about it this way, one, you get that mortgage deductibility, tax deductibility. Two, instead of $870 going to a house, an apartment that you're renting, in which you have no equity stake building, you buy a house, even if housing prices go down, as long as you keep your payments up, you have a place to live. But you also have an equity stake that grows year over year, provided the house doesn't fall in value. So there are all kinds of reasons why this is a reasonable thing to do, to buy a house. And to do this calculation, you're saying to yourself, well, $145,000 is kind of a modest house. Not really. Think about it. $145,000, that could buy a very nice house trailer. Seriously. With the Elvis velvet paintings on the walls and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. Shag carpeting. Uh-huh. And indoor toilet. Yeah, we're talking good. King of Decatur, if you put it there. Okay, so anyway. This was brought up to me as a suggestion from one of the loan officers. And I said, okay, well, can you do that with cars too? And he said, absolutely. He said, you should actually, whenever you're thinking about what car you want to afford, go back to that original thing. What was the take-home salary? It was a take-home pay per month with like $2,900. Okay, let me clear this out. Let's do $2,900. Oops. He said, he gave an actual interesting explanation. He said, you take away all of your other monthly expenses. You look at your utility bills and all this kind of stuff, blah, blah, blah. And he said, my rule of thumb for this is, he said, you take away about 45% of what you take home and minus 0.45 times 2,900, and that's your take home. That's your disposable after you've paid your bills for the month and all that kind of stuff. And then he said, generally speaking, he said, we like to see that payment stay around 25 to 30% for your car. So let's take that times 25%. So you can get a $400 a month payment on a car. Okay, let's go back to the grinder here. Let's reset. And let's say that for this loan, which would be a 60-month, a five-year car loan, with an interest rate on that one of 6.99% annually, 12 payments per year, we will want to keep our payments at around $400 a month. And now, payment, $4, yeah, you get yourself a Yugo. Okay, payment, enter. Now, let's compute. Well, let's try that again. I screwed that up and everything went to hell after that. 60 months, 6.99% APR, and we want our payments to stay, 12 payments per year, and we want to keep our payments to about $400 per month payment, compute the present value. My ass. I was just testing your ass there, okay? Compute your... Well, why did you tell me that before I... Well, that's not bad. 20 grand car. I mean, you're not going to buy that Ford F-150 you were looking at. So that's how you would do it. Before you even went to the bank and asked for a loan, you would do this quick, dirty calculation and say, well, okay, this is what I can afford. The affordability tells me that I can get about a 20 grand car. Of course, you're not going to aim for 20. You look for something under 20. Like 18, and then you go into the car dealership and say, I will buy this car. You prearrange with the bank, $18,000, $20,000 in line of credit. Then you go to the car dealership. I have to have it out the door for below that, tax and title and everything, below that amount right there. And I've already got it arranged. All you have to do is say yes, and we can get you a cashier's check tomorrow. That's all there is to it. That's how you do this affordability thing. Last trick up my sleeve. This goes back to some really, one more thing. The thing of it is that most cash flows that you've encountered so far, and many of them in our actual lives, are level. But there are some that have all kinds of irregularities in them, like your sales is going to go up and down, so the present value of your sales is going to be weird. But there is a security that has an oddity, an oddball pattern to it. Like I said, consumer debt is not like corporate and government debt. With consumer debt, the payment is calculated so that you are paying principal and interest in every payment. In other words, you are amortizing the loan and servicing the debt at the same time. This makes for an interesting question on an exam. Distinguish between corporate debt and private debt. But anyway, hint, hint, nudge, nudge, wink, wink. Okay, anyway, look, corporate debt and government debt doesn't work that way. At the beginning of the contract is for the corporation or the government to pay back $1,000 or a multiple of that in a stated number of years. $1,000 is paid back to the lender. Along the way, an agreed upon interest rate on that $1,000 is paid every year. It's actually paid every semi-annually, but we won't do that with this one. So in other words, I would say I would lend this corporation, a big mega corporation, I would lend the corporation, you, sir, you want to borrow $1,000 for 30 years. We set up a bond agreement where I will lend you something like $1,000. Maybe not exactly $1,000, but something around $1,000. And you will agree to pay me 8%. The coupon is what it's called. You'll pay me a coupon rate of 8% of that $1,000 every year for 30 years, and then you will pay me back the $1,000. You'll make me one last $80 payment to me, and you will give me my $1,000 back. The nasty part of that is that it is a perfectly level annuity, ordinary level annuity, $80 every year for 30 years, except that it has one pisser in it. $1,000 blob at the end. And that's where it gets to be a pain in the ass. ADR, Inc. has issued a 6.8% 30-year bond.
It just did it.
The problem with this is that the market might not think that 6.8% is exactly right. Now, we try to aim and hit it on the head. What does the market want for the level of risk? But sometimes we're off, and definitely after a time, that 6.8% might be very different from what the market wants. So, suppose the market expected 7.0% instead. Price the security. Price the security. We're going to do that right now. It's actually really easy to do, but for God's sake, you have to know where to put the numbers. What number goes in what slot here? Now, the one thing I mentioned to you right off the bat in the course, no, unless I said differently, which I probably never would, corporate and government bonds have a face value of $1,000. You will get $1,000 or a multiple of $1,000 back. That's just how it is. I don't need to tell you the face value. Okay. Now, this company issued 6.8% to the lenders. It's going to pay them 6.8% interest. They wanted 7%. So when they lend the money, are they going to be happy or sad? I lend him $1,000. He's going to pay me $68 a year. I wanted $70 a year. So am I going to be happy or am I going to be sad about getting $68 instead of $70? Okay, sad. Now, sad in finance means pissed off. Okay, so I am going to punish him. Spankings. No, I'm going to do something to punish him. We'll see what the punishment is here in just a minute. Just put it in. Don't ask why. God, I hate when you ask why before you know how to do something. Watch. 30 years. Okay, so we're going to do this. Actually, technically, bonds pay two coupons, half each every year, but we'll just do it as annual coupons. For 30 years is N. Enter it. Now, the payments are going to be the coupon. Payment coupon. It's going to be $68. Not 6.8, it's 68 bucks is the payment that will be paid every year. The 7% comes in because that's the discount rate that the market is going to apply to the $68 coupons. So the discount rate is going to be the I over Y. The coupon rate in dollars will be the payment. Again, let me say that again. The discount rate will be the I over Y. What we call the yield to maturity. The payment is going to be the coupon expressed in dollars. Always. Now, there's one last little trick in this one, though. Because at the end, there's a $1,000 face value that will be paid back as future value. Don't ever, with a bond, forget to put in that $1,000. Oh, and by the way, make sure that when you go to your next calculation, if it's not a bond, get that $1,000 out of there because it is just for bonds that this happens. Okay, now we're ready to figure out what the price value of this bond is. Now, if I think that the deal is perfectly fair, you're servicing my debt, right? You're paying me my interest every year. So I should think that I'm getting $1,000 back at the end. The price I lent you should be $1,000. But if I don't like it, I'm going to punish you. Shoot. Well, spank me, Jesus. You're only going to get $975 from me because you screwed me on the payments. I wanted $70 payments. You gave me $68. I'm going to lend you only $975.18. That bond is going to sell, write this down for God's sake, that bond is going to sell at a discount to par. That bond is going to sell at a discount to par. See, I'm going to get you either way. You're not paying me enough in the coupons, so I'm not going to lend you. You're still going to have to pay me back $1,000, but I'm going to lend you only $975 because your coupon payments aren't going to cover it. Now, suppose instead that you were Mr. Generosity. You paid 7.3% coupon. $73. You're just that kind of a guy. Now I'm the lender. I want 7%. You're going to pay me 7.3%. I want to see a $70 check every year. You're going to give me a $73 check every year. That's going to make me happy. So in other words, the only thing that would change in my equation, in my calculation, was instead of that $68, I would put in $73 for the payment. Let's see what happens to the price. $1,037. This bond now sells at a premium to par. The bond sells at a premium to par. You see, I'm going to give you a little extra candy. Hey, you're going to pay me $70. I wanted $70 a year. You're going to give me $73? I'll lend you a little more. Now, there's one last thing that I'm going to warn you about. Watch it when I do this on tests, or when I'm talking especially. In the language of Wall Street, we would not say $1,037.23. We would say 103.73 or 103.72. Quotes are always a tenth of bond price. Quotes are always a tenth of bond. You look in the paper, my favorite story, I swear to you this happened. I knew this guy years ago, Frank was his name. He imagined himself an amateur professional day trader investor. I don't need to go to no damn college. I know how to do it. He bought himself all the software that was the coolest of the time back in the early 90s, a computer that was the most powerful of its era, a DX386. I mean, he started investing. And he stepped into bonds and he looked at a bond price. And he saw the bond price. And it was similar to this one. Hang on. Let me go back and put the 68 in. He saw the bond prices for the day. Oops. I want 68 in there. Of 97.52. It was something very similar. Very close to that, actually. So he ordered 10 of them. I got out of the grand, I'm going to put into bonds. And so he saw the quotes streaming at 97.52. It was in that area. It was something like 98. He got his bill for $9,900. So he almost had a heart attack. He was a smoker and a drinker. What the hell? Frank, you didn't know? Those were a test. Who did that? That's a real. How long has that been? Well, Frank, actually, since stocks and bonds have been trading, bonds have always been quoted at a tenth of their actual value. And the historical reason was the old broadsheets that they were printed in back in the 1700s and 1800s, there was limited space. So what they did was they just made the convention that bonds would quote at a tenth. So they didn't have to put $1,000. They could put more columns on the broadsheet. And so to this day, you will see the quotes on bonds, and they are a tenth of the actual price. The price of that bond is $975.18. The quote is $97.52 on the bond. $97.52. So watch it. If I ever ask you, quote a bond, don't give me the price. And it's not a dollar sign. It's a pure number. It's not a dollar sign. So you would write 975.52, no dollar sign. It's just a straight up number. But if I say, what's the price? Well, the price is $975.18. Just keep that in mind. If you're ever investing, watch out for these little things, these nuances, historical artifacts and fossils that can come back to bite you in the butt sometimes with these prices and quotes. But anyway, as you can see, if you have a coupon that is less than the yield to maturity, as we call it, well, your bond is going to sell at a discount to par. However, if you have a coupon that is better than the yield to maturity, then your bond will sell did you see how I almost got that really cool there? The hell with it. Anyway, payment, enter. Will sell at a premium to par. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.